Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on forensics when we come back. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there is no cause for alarm. But submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. And the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Well, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control. But we haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our judicial system. It doesn't come from the political process. It doesn't come from our politicians. We don't see it in our lawyers or bureaucrats. You know, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts. It's not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of the courts, then call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about forensics. Forensics, that's the science that goes behind a lot of what goes on in our courtrooms. It's the science that shows us that that guy over there did these horrible acts and we're going to convict him. We don't have eyewitnesses. There wasn't any confession that came out of this guy, but the hair that we found in the trunk of his car is the hair from the victim that we found bound up and gagged and dead in the river. And so at least it shows this. It shows that this guy had some kind of contact with that victim, or else how did that hair get in the trunk of his car? Ah, but what if the police took the hair out of the victim, and then the policeman is carrying this hair around in his, say, in an envelope, you know, in his patrol car, and he finds somebody, and he pulls him over, and then he searches this guy's trunk, and he puts that hair in the trunk, and then he arrests the guy. And for some other reason, or he arrests him for this murder or whatever it is. And so they look in the trunk and they find this hair. And then the crime lab identifies the hair as being an identical match from the hair that came out of the victim. And so now we have forensics at its best, framing somebody for a crime that he did not commit. And we have the policeman over here who is carrying out this hit on this innocent victim. How often does that occur? I can't tell you, but it does occur, and it occurs with regularity. And that's what we're learning in this series on forensics, that what we see in the movies or what we see on television and what actually goes on out here in the real world are totally disconnected. They don't have any connecting links at all. One is pure fantasy, and then there's the real world. So last time I pointed out that here at the law school we're concerned with, in fact, it's the primary reason for this law school's existence. It's to teach and train lay people to stay out of trouble. Now, you can stay out of a whole lot more trouble than you can get out of. And I point out from time to time the incompetence of the lawyers in general in the country. Not to say that every lawyer is incompetent, or that every policeman is corrupt, or that every crime lab technician is incompetent. That's not true. And I'm not advocating that. But when you have 300,000 people locked up in prison, 15% of the population that we know is innocent, I say that that's too many. I don't know how many is enough, but I'm pretty well convinced personally that 15% is way more than we need to have in there. I've been to jail a time or two. I understand jail. I understand police work, and I understand false confessions, and I understand don't make any marks on him, and pain compliance. I'm familiar with all of that, boys. And I think that it ought to be terminated. I don't believe in it, and I don't think that it's a part and parcel of the American way. I don't think prosecuting attorneys have to convict innocent people, and I don't think that they have to force confessions out of people down at the police department. And I don't think that they have to use the power of suggestion to get lay witnesses to falsely identify innocent people in order to win convictions. I don't believe that's true. And furthermore, even if we had another 300,000 people on the streets who were in fact guilty, I would say that that's a fair price to pay for keeping the 300,000 people out of prison who are, in fact, innocent. Now, last time I was pointing out to you that it's a crime when science gets it wrong. Now, we believe in science here in America, and I don't deny that. We believe in it like we believe in our lawyers, like we believe in our doctors and hospitals and our medical practice over here, but it's not necessarily the best in the world. And I was pointing out to you here that time after time, juries believe experts in ballistics, fingerprint identification, hair analysis, and other forensic disciplines who were wrong, who were lying, or who were both lying and wrong. And the vast majority of the cases weren't handled by the Houston Police Crime Lab. The problem is broader than that. The analysis was presented last month in an article in the respected journal Science. The authors were Jonathan Kohler, a behavioral scientist specializing in legal issues at the University of Texas at the McComb School of Business, and Michael Sachs. He's a professor of law and psychology at Arizona State University College of Law Center, Law's Center for the Study of Law, Science, and Technology. The world's top expert. It's an optimistic article, sort of. DNA analysis, the authors say, has provided a scientific standard for forensics. It was developed through a scientific process. DNA was critiqued by a wide variety of scientists. Standards were developed for conducting DNA tests and for reporting them. Now, I want to point out, boys and girls, that DNA is not 100% true, accurate, and correct. But the difference between DNA and forensic science is that DNA analysis actually has a false positive reaction rate that's measurable. We can tell you how often we're wrong. And that's where the fingerprint people fall down, because fingerprint people will tell you fingerprints are perfect. They are absolute. And we know that that's false, and I reported that to you in this series of programs. It's good. No doubt about that. Fingerprint identification is good, but it's not flawless, and it doesn't have a 0% false negative rate. Now, DNA doesn't have a 100% false negative rate either, but they can identify what their error rate is. It's good, but it's not perfect. But that's what science is. It's something that we can demonstrate and we can do over and over again in independent laboratories. And if it's done by skilled people, we will get consistent results each and every time. And after all, that's what we want. All we're interested in is the truth. Are you, in fact, this heinous murderer who is killing these little children? And if that's the case, we want to catch you and put you out of action. Now, the police and the FBI, you know, in their defense, and I'll take a moment here to describe for you a couple of cases. down in Atlanta, Georgia, I mentioned this to you the other day, there was a serial killer down there who was killing little black boys. He's a black guy himself, but he's killing little black boys. And he killed about 20 of them. And then they convicted this guy with a forensic laboratory. They identified the hair of one of the victims, and it was in this guy's the trunk of his car. One hair or six hairs or whatever it was. Now, the fact that we know that this guy was in fact guilty is that the serial crimes stopped. As soon as they arrested this guy, put him in jail, there were no more killings. Now somebody's going to say, yeah, but the real killer, he stopped killing. No, he didn't. Serial killers don't ever stop killing. This serial killer stopped killing. So that being the case, then we're pretty sure we got the right guy. In any event, even if this guy is innocent and it prompted the real guy to stop killing people, that was a step in the right direction, wasn't it? Maybe that's a small price to pay for stopping the serial crimes. Now, that was one case that came down. And then the FBI caught two serial killers. Remember those two shooters that were up in Washington and Baltimore and around that neck of the woods there? Just shooting people out of the trunk of their car. And they killed about, I don't know, six or eight people, shot another six or eight people, and they're just going around shooting people at random, killing them. Now, you know, the average Joe Sixpack or the average policeman's not able to catch that kind of a criminal. And so the FBI came in there, and they did a profile and said, what kind of a person are we looking for? And then, you know, it wasn't too long later that they caught these two guys, having both of them be black, but come to find out they'd been killing people, you know, all over the United States. So we need police. We need the FBI. I'm not opposed to the FBI. They come here to the law school every now and again, you know, every few years we'll see a FBI man come through here. And for the most part, those guys are pretty good guys, and they're working pretty hard. And they're trying their best. At least that's my impression of them. But then why do we have 300,000 people locked up in prison that are innocent, that we know about? Hey, kids, somebody's fallen down on the job. So without pointing our fingers at anybody, what are we going to do to protect ourselves? I'm not an idealist here. I don't think that we're going to change prosecutors and police tactics and techniques. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to inform myself so that I know what the police are going to do to me, how they're going to get me to falsely confess to a crime I didn't commit, how the prosecutor, 28% of the time, is going to prosecute me knowing that I'm innocent, and how 44% of the time the police are going to come in and they are going to phony up evidence and testimony to convict me. I'm going to inform myself of that so that I've got a running start on the process, so that when I come into court, I'm prepared to prove that I'm innocent. I'm prepared to prove that the prosecutor is prosecuting me incorrectly and violating the rules, and that the policeman is a liar. Now, I'm prepared to do that, and I'm prepared to teach you how to do that. I think that's step number one. Now, step number two, if a mistake has been made, the judicial process has a formula for proving your innocence. But it's a hell of a lot harder to prove your innocence from inside prison than it is to prove your innocence prior to going to trial or at the trial itself. That's my point. It when you're in prison, and we get, as I pointed out last time, we get a lot of letters here from prisoners, and they say, hey, I'm innocent, and I'd like to prove that. We have a process here. We have a plan here at the law school. If you're locked up in prison and you've got somebody on the outside, we have a relatively inexpensive methodology in a training program to train you to extricate yourself from your own morass. Not that you're going to come here and hire me and I'm going to go do this for you, like 60 Minutes or you know, like Morley Safer used to do, or maybe Mike Wallace. Or a Barbara Walters, but rather to teach and train your wife on the outside, to teach and train your brother or your father or mother. And this is what you have to do if you're going to prove that you're innocent from inside that jail. It can be done. It's been done hundreds of times. It's done every day. I say every day, at least once a week. That's 50 times a year. Here's 86 cases that I'm reporting on right here in this one article. And I reported in this series here 200 cases, 10 a year of murder people, you know, people that have been convicted for murder that have been uncovered and that have been released. So it isn't impossible. So if you're innocent and you're locked up in jail and you're one of these 300,000 and you're listening to this program or you know of somebody that's in prison and you want to get them out, there is a process for doing that. But you're not going to find it at the police department. You're not going to find it in the legal profession. You're not going to find it in the courts, and you're not going to find it down here with the prosecutor's office or with the city council or with the mayor or with the governor or with the legislature. They're trying to hide all of it. And so far, they've done a pretty good job. They don't want to pay out $9 million, as I reported to you last time. So if they've got you locked up falsely, they're going to bury you just as deep as they can. Hell, you're more dangerous to the establishment than the guilty guys they've got locked up. At least the guilty guys that are locked up belong there. It's this 300,000 that don't belong there. They don't want the lawsuits. They don't want the hassles. So if you're going to release yourself, then you got to have a Barry Scheck or a Jerry Spence or a Nephilim Bailey or a Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes or a Barbara Walters, or you've got to do it yourself. Now, if you're in prison, you know you got nothing to do but go down to the law library and start digging into the books. And if you've got somebody that's in jail, you know, you're a whole lot more interested in getting that guy out of jail than I am. I don't have any personal connecting link with your loved one in prison. But if you do, then the law school here is designed. We opened this law school back in 1981 with the express interest, with the express intent of teaching lay people the law. And we're about as popular in legal circles as AIDS at an office Christmas party. I'm viewed as a scab in a union shop. And you union people all know that we don't like scabs in a union shop. And that's the way they see me. See, I'm not a licensed lawyer. I'm operating a law school, and I'm over here teaching lay people. I'm not teaching lawyers now. We're not trying to turn out a cadre of more and more lawyers. We've already got more lawyers than any other country in the world. In fact, the last time I saw some numbers, I think we Americans have more lawyers in America than all the rest of the world combined. We're not short of lawyers here. We got plenty of them. In fact, in Washington, D.C., I saw some numbers the other day. I think there's a lawyer in Washington, D.C. for every 65 people that live in the metropolitan area. But if you need real legal expertise, you're going to have to develop it yourself. If you want to get out of prison and you've been wrongly convicted, you're going to have to do this. Nobody's going to do it for you. That's not going to happen, and I'm not going to do it for you either. I mean, you know, I can't get 300,000 people out of jail. Hell, I know I'm just an old man. I don't have the time, effort, or energy to do that. But I've got the expertise to teach you how to do it. I can do that. It's kind of like I'm an old-timey plumber, you know. I'm not going to come out here and fix every leaky pipe in the city of Los Angeles, but I can start teaching you people how to fix your own leaky pipes. DNA analysis, the authors say, has provided a scientific standard for forensic. And in DNA, we say, here are the chances of a match, and here's the frequency with which we make an error, Kohler told me Friday. By contrast, he said, a ballistics expert might say, in effect, it's a match. This bullet came through this gun. I know because I'm the world's top expert. Boys and girls, that's not science. That's purely subjective. And that's my point. Just because some crime lab says that this bullet is a match doesn't make that true. It ought to be tested by an independent crime lab. It ought to be tested by some other laboratory, whether it's a crime lab or not.
to see whether or not that's true. You know, there's other laboratories that have the ability or they have the expertise to test that bullet. You don't have to rely on the state crime lab. The evidence that comes out of the state crime lab is more than likely going to be prejudiced against the defendant. And if you're just alerted to the fact that some of the time, I don't know how much of the time, but much of the time, that's faulty evidence and faulty crime lab work. Now, what's more, there has been remarkably little research on the accuracy of traditional forensic sciences. Did you get that, boys and girls? There is remarkably very little research on the accuracy of this information that comes out of these traditional forensic sciences. Now, we've been taught, and we all believe that it's absolutely ironclad, that it's 100% bulletproof, that it's perfect, that every report that comes out of the crime lab is true, accurate, and correct to the dot at the end of the sentence. That's totally false. Totally false. Now, these sciences became science largely by saying they were science. You know, the ballistics guy says, well, it's the science of ballistics. There isn't any science of ballistics or the science of fingerprints. I showed you. There is no science of fingerprints. It's totally subjective. Is it accurate? Much of the time it's accurate, but some of the time it's inaccurate. How much of the time is it inaccurate? We don't know. But we've got enough test cases that we can say, well, it's not bulletproof. At least with DNA, that's a real science. DNA is a real science because it has an error rate. So when the FBI guy says that there is a zero error rate in fingerprinting, is poppycock. I showed you that in this series of programs. That's not true. But it's accepted as being true by jurors when they're sitting on the jury. It's accepted by most defense lawyers, especially you young kids coming out of the law schools, and you're working at the public defender's office, and you're over here defending this poor klutz who probably can't even read, write, and spell. And so you believe that the crime lab over here has the goods on your defendant or on your client, and you say, well, might as well plead guilty to this, son. And he takes your advice, and he pleads guilty to something he didn't do. You know, I think we could all do a little better job. Prosecutors can do a better job. Police can do a better job by just being honest. It's a wild new concept, I know, but, you know, just do your job. You're all trade professionals. You know right and wrong. Just stick with the right and ignore the wrong, and you won't be locking up nearly as many innocent people. And by the way, what great kick do you policemen get out of forcing a confession out of some guy that you know is innocent? How do you sleep at night? How do you live with yourself knowing that you have put somebody in a lineup and then cunningly coerced some traumatized female to identify that guy as the rapist? How does that advance your career? How does that put more money in your paycheck every week? I often wonder about that, you know. How does a prosecutor, when he goes home, I guess a lawyer, you know, could probably go home and sleep soundly at night after having done that. After all, it's just business. It's kind of like a guy working at Murder Incorporated, you know. He's had a long night. He had to kill three people. You know, he made $75,000 tonight, but, you know, business has been slow, and we don't know when the next job is going to come in. I don't know, kids. I guess there's some people that can live like that, and there's some of us, you know, that just recoil at the concepts that are being advanced here in modern 21st century America. Well, forensic scientists often argue that the science is infallible. Any problems are due to human error. But as Kohler points out, where the error occurs, it matters very little to the jury or to the person who's being wrongly imprisoned. Kohler and Sachs propose subjecting crime labs to blind testing, in which technicians are tested with samples that appear to be a part of their regular work. These tests should be conducted by an independent agency, and the results should be made public as with any mainstream science. Hey, I'm going to come back and say, amen, brother. as the religious people would do. Amen, brother. Let's just take some evidence and stick it in to the crime lab and see what kind of results we get from it. I mean, we know where this hair came from, and we know the answer to this riddle over here. But let's just dummy it up and send it into the crime lab and see if they'll come back with an honest result. Or maybe it's human error, or maybe it's just bad science. And then maybe we ought to walk in there and see if we can bribe them or say, well, listen, would you come into court and testify to that? Because we need your testimony to convict this guy, and we know he's just guilty as hell. And let's find out how many of these crime lab technicians are actually scientists and how many of them are like this guy I reported on in the first program in the series, just a bunch of frauds. Hell, this guy hadn't even gotten his degree, you know, in criminology, for crying out loud. The FBI does their own testing and says, we've done our testing and we're perfect and you can't look at our data because we're the FBI. So the FBI does their own testing, and then they say, well, you can't second guess us or test us or come to us and say that we need to have our results repeated by some other lab because we're the FBI. Boys and girls, that's flipping a coin. That has nothing to do with science. Science is something that can be repeated over and over again in anybody's laboratory. Science is truth. Science is fact. Science is this is the way it is. Now, we've been told that that's what we're receiving, but that's not what we're receiving. We're buying it, we're paying for it, but we're not receiving it. Now, let me show you something else here. Do you know what it costs to lock a guy up in jail? Of the 300,000 people that are locked up in prison, do you know what you people are paying to lock somebody up in jail? Well, the answer is, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 people times $35,000 a year at the low end to as much as $425,000 at the high end. There's one prison, there's a federal prison in the United States where the cost of incarceration is $425,000 a year. That's the highest priced prison in the country. And then down here at the local level, you know, the state penitentiary, you know, say in Boise, Idaho, it's around $35,000 a year. That's the cheap end. Just take 35,000 times 300,000. Let's just do that. 300,000 times 35,000. And my machine goes into a 0E, whatever that means. So my Sharp EL1197 can't handle that number. Let me see if I can do that here by hand. 300,000. Gotta forgive me, I'm just a plumber, not a mathematician. Times 35,000. So let's take 35 times 300,000, then add three zeros. Let's try that one. 300,000 times 35 gives us 10,500. So let's write down 10,500. And then let's add three zeros to that, and then let's go 369. Well, that's $10,500,000,000 a year to lock up these 300,000 innocent people. Costs us an extra $10.5 billion a year. You know, we could probably spend that money better. You know, we could probably spend it on the Iraq War or do something more constructive with it, don't you think? The FBI does their own testing, he says. And the FBI says, we've done our testing and we're perfect. We are perfect. One of the reasons forensic science is so fallible, the authors write, is that 96% of the positions are held by persons with bachelor's degrees or less. By contrast, in normal science, academically gifted students receive 4 or more years of doctoral training, where much of the socialization into the culture takes place, and this culture emphasizes methodological rigor, openness, and cautious interpretation of data. Forensic science, by contrast, is an adversarial crime-fighting culture where there often is pressure to produce findings that support police and prosecutors. Now, there's the real bottom line. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story here. When you're being prosecuted, it's the state of Michigan versus Joe Sixpack. the state of Michigan versus Joe Sixpack. So there's an entity over here called the state of Michigan. It could be Boise Cascade Corporation or General Motors or some corporation. That's what your problem is. There's a corporation that's suing you. That's what the bottom line is. And the Michigan Corporation has a legislature that has created a judicial or an adjudicatory system or process called the court. And so the state of Michigan initiates a complaint against you, and the next thing you know, you find yourself in court. Now, whose court is this that you're going into? Well, it's the state of Michigan's court. What if you were being complained about by General Motors and you were taken into the General Motors court? What would you think of that? So the state of Michigan hauls you into the state of Michigan's court. And who is presiding here in the state of Michigan's court? It's the state of Michigan's judge. Now, the state of Michigan's judge is being paid for by the state of Michigan, who is the complaining party in this case, are they not? So now we're in the Michigan court in front of the Michigan judge being complained about by the plaintiff, the state of Michigan. Now the rules for this court are manufactured by who? The rules of the court are manufactured by the state of Michigan. And there's a prosecutor in this court. And who's paying his salary every Friday? Well, it's the state of Michigan. Then there's a policeman who's going to come in and testify against you, and who's paying his salary? Well, it's the plaintiff, the state of Michigan again. Now, we've got to have evidence against you, so we go to the crime lab to develop this forensic evidence that we're going to use against you, and who's paying the salaries of the people that work in the forensic lab? Well, again, it's the plaintiff, the state of Michigan. Now, the judge says to you, now listen, maybe you don't understand this process. So we're going to appoint an attorney to represent you, called the public defender. And this guy is a licensed paid professional. And he's licensed by who? Well, the state of Michigan, the plaintiff. And if you don't want him, you can hire an attorney and pay for him with your own money. You can pay for your attorney through your taxes, or you can pay for your attorney through your bank account or your checking account. And who is he? Well, he's licensed by the state of Michigan. Now, let's analyze this again. You're being complained about by the state of Michigan, a corporation, who has a judicial system or forum that they want to bring you into, and so they do, and they make the rules for this forum called the court, and then they hire a judge and pay a salary every Friday. Well, who wears his allegiance? And then he got a prosecutor and a policeman and a forensic laboratory witness who's going to testify against you and prosecute you, and all these guys are being bought and paid for by the state of Michigan. And then they come to you and say, well, we'd like to give you a defense attorney, and who's paying this guy's salary? Well, it's the state of Michigan again. So you're in the state of Michigan's court being complained about by the state of Michigan, in front of the state of Michigan's judge, being prosecuted under the state of Michigan's rules, prosecuted by the state of Michigan's prosecutor, witnessed against by the state of Michigan's policeman and forensic laboratory witnesses, and defended by the state of Michigan's attorney. And we call this a fair trial now. For the rest of you people in the world, we Americans call that a fair trial. Well, boys and girls, what if I brought you into my law school? This is the Gordon Law School. And I got a complaint against you. So I present the complaint. And I'm going to prosecute you in the Gordon Law School court, which is going to be operated under the Gordon Law School rules. And it's going to be George Gordon, the Gordon Law School's founder, who is complaining about your behavior, driving too fast down my lane. And then I'm going to have my son testify against you. My wife is going to act as the prosecutor. My daughter is going to run the crime lab and produce the pictures and the evidence that we have against you. And then to show you how fair I want to be, I'm going to bring my son-in-law in and have him represent you at my expense. And we're going to call this a fair trial. What do you think of that? boys and girls. If you think that's insane, well, what in the hell do you think's going on out here in the real world? Why do you think we got 300,000 people locked up in prison who are innocent, that we know about, that we admit to? Well, Kohler thinks we're headed in the right direction, but we have a long way to go. Some people twist our words into saying we believe no forensic science should come into court, he said. Well, I don't believe that. I just believe that we're far better off with forensic science that is real science rather than hocus pocus. And I agree with the guy. I agree with the guy, and that's what we do here at the law school. We think that justice is better, and is a better program than the adversarial system. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here at the halfway point in the program that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. And remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. You know, that's the place to start. Find out what we're all about. If you'd like to order one, they're free. Just call us at the law school and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network, or of this local radio station. Again, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. CSI. There's a TV program my daughter likes to watch every week, and she copies it. And she's a pretty knowledgeable young woman. She's no dummy. And she works here in the law school, and she's pretty knowledgeable, you know, about law and one thing and another. And she watches the CSI, because these cop shows actually teach us. We actually learn a little something from them each and every time. A lot of the time, we learn a lot of false nonsense that's going on. So that's that's good for us here at the law school. We can learn from the nonsense that we see, but we can also learn from the truth that we see. And the problem with CSI and the problem with these cop shows is that you have truth plus error. And what you have here is deception. That's what it boils down to. It's deception. And there's a motivation behind the deception. What we're showing here is the invincibility of the law, the invincibility of the police, the invincibility of the system. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. You can beat City Hall. In fact, I put a series of programs on, and you can go to the archives, and you'll see you can beat City Hall. I've done it many times. My students do it regularly, and so can you. The cost of learning how to do this by going to law school is pretty expensive. If you want to become an attorney, it's going to cost you somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000. And that's assuming that you don't go to Yale or Harvard or Princeton or some, you know, prestigious law school, but just, you know, an average run-of-the-mill law school. And the average guy, you know, he doesn't have $100,000. Well, it's a whole lot less expensive to learn how to do this on your own. This law school is a do-it-yourself type of law school where we're going to teach you how to do-it-yourself plumbing or do-it-yourself carpentry or do-it-yourself law. Oftentimes, people will call the law school and say, oh my God, I didn't know it was that expensive. Boys and girls, this law school isn't one-tenth the price of a law school that you go to out there in a four-year or a five-year degree school. And that's because we're not offering degrees to teach you how to be a lawyer so you can go out and represent clients. We're teaching you how to be your own lawyer, how to go in and get your own results, how to get justice for yourself. That's what our objective is. You can't get justice as a general rule, as a Joe Sixpack out here on the street. Now, if you're an IBM or a Bill Gates in Microsoft, or you're a multinational corporation, oh, you can get all the justice that money can buy. There's plenty of it out there, and it's all for sale. But if you want to go into court and defend yourself, and you've been charged with drunk driving, or you've been charged with rape, or you've been charged with this or that, or as I've pointed out in this series of programs, you're one of the guys that has actually been convicted and you're innocent. How do you extricate yourself from your dilemma? And then, of course, a lot of guys, you know, that are guilty actually believe that they're innocent. I've had students, you know, come through here that I knew were guilty. And they maintain their innocence. And the judicial system's not stupid, you know. Those people are not sitting there for no good purpose. But they're not there to help the guy that is actually innocent. And I think that we should have an advocacy over here for people that are actually innocent. Now, the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, pardoned in his last few days of office before he left office. He pardoned a whole host and plethora of people that were just guilty as hell. And presidents can do that. They can pardon you. I think it's a travesty of justice, but, you know, that's the political process. But meanwhile, back here on the farm, there's some actual real people out here in America, and in fact in Canada and Australia and all over the world. And you've been locked up, and you're actually innocent, and you'd like to have an opportunity to prove you're innocent. Well, your prison has a law library. And if it doesn't have a law library, it should have one. And the law provides for one, and they have to have one. And here in the United States, there's legislation, laws in place that require it. And there's ways for you to get law books. You can get every law book that is not in the prison law library. Did you know that? There's a methodology for getting law books that aren't even in the prison law library. Books that you may need to prove your innocence. Books that you can't get and they're not going to provide. Books that you've never heard of. And you can get them. But you got to know how. And that's the problem. You see, most of you do not know how to do this. So you've heard me mention these 28 things that you need to know in courtroom strategy and procedure. 28. Not 228, not 5,000. Just 28 things you got to know. And if you don't know, then you don't know what it is that you don't know, and therefore you can never extricate yourself from the problem because there's some information you've got to have, and you don't have it, and you don't know what it is that you don't know. I know. I've got it. But I'm not the guy that's going to get you out of prison. And I'm not the guy that's going to keep you out of prison. But you could keep yourself out of prison. You know, you could keep yourself or get yourself out if you put your mind to it. And so that's the thrust of the law school here, the Gordon Law School. That is to teach lay people. You could be a truck driver, a housewife. You can be a small businessman. You can have problems with OSHA, the EPA, the BATF, or some other government agency, you know, the IRS, or whoever it happens to be. And all of these agencies are governed by law, and there is a legal remedy for every one of you out there. No matter what your legal problem is, there is a legal remedy for your problem. Designed. There's other people who have already been through this. Other people have already had this problem. Your case has already been adjudicated. There's somebody out there that's gone on before you, and there are winners and there are losers. Whether you're a homeschooler or you're a tax evader, or you're some guy that's been convicted and you're in jail today, or hell, you might have been convicted wrongly and you want to clear your name, for crying out loud. You know, there's a methodology for doing that. You can reopen your case. There are jurisdictional defects. There are all kinds of defenses. There's all kinds of things that if you knew or if your attorney had known. You know, oftentimes you attorneys out there are ignorant. You don't know. I pointed out to you here that James Nielsen, you know, he's a law school professor, and he says, you know, what we're turning out of our law schools over here is a crying shame. That's what Jerry Spence says, and that's been my observation also. Most lawyers are a crying shame. Not all, but, you know. Well, I'll tell you another little part of the story here. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, his name was Warren Burger, back in 1978, said 90% of the lawyers, trial lawyers, what he's referring to, 90% of the trial lawyers in America are incompetent. And that was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. That wasn't George Gordon said that. That was your own Chief Justice. Let's take a look at CSI, Science Eluding Real Life Crime Labs. A study has found that the on-hit TV shows like CSI and Crossing Jordan, crime-solving forensic science may produce slam-dunk evidence and tidy endings. In real life, forensic science is far less certain. The underlying principles of the identification forensic sciences have never been rigorously scientifically proven, said Jay Siegel, director of the undergraduate forensic science program at Indiana Purdue University in Indianapolis. This includes handwriting, fingerprints, firearms, and tool marks, he said. And according to a new study, traditional forensic analysis often relies on untested assumptions and semi-informed guesswork. And it can also sometimes produce the wrong result. Drawing on data from 86 DNA exoneration cases, the researchers found that forensic science testing errors and false or misleading testimony by forensic scientists had been leading causes in the false convictions. One of the researchers, Jonathan Kohler, says it's time for forensic sciences to adopt the culture of other sciences, and this includes being more conservative, requiring empirical support for claims, adopting higher professional standards, and generally conceding the important role that the possibility of error plays in interpreting results, said Kohler, who is a professor of behavioral decision making at the University of Texas in Austin. The study appears in the current issue of the journal Science, and there's discernible uniqueness. Little research has been conducted on the accuracy of traditional forensic sciences, such as the analysis of handwriting, firearms, firearm marks, fingerprints, hairs, and fibers. My guess is that the broader scientific community just assumed that the claims and assumptions of the traditional forensic sciences were rigorously tested at an earlier time, Kohler said. Courts have historically been impressed with the legal testimony of experts simply because of their credentials. So let me interject here that some guy comes in, and he's an expert, and he says, well, I'm an expert in firearms. I'm an expert in DNA. I'm an expert in. And so, who challenged them? Who cross-examined these experts on the witness stand? You know, cross-examination is the most valuable skill that you can develop. It isn't something you're born with. It's something that you develop. It's like learning a skill. It's like learning to play the piano. The more you play the piano, my daughter plays the piano, and I noticed that when she first started, it was kind of plink, plink, plink. Now she plays beautiful pieces on the piano. I mean, that girl is really good. Really good. You know, she's not a Liberace by any stretch of the imagination, but I mean, she's a good piano player. And, you know, cross-examination is the same thing. I remember the first case I ever went in on cross-examination. The guy that I had on the witness stand was the county prosecutor. I put him on the witness stand to get some information out of him, and the guy just ate my lunch. I asked that guy 16 questions. He objected 16 times, and he was sustained 16 out of 16. I never had a beating like that. I mean, shucks, even in the 10th grade, I never got a beating like that. And when I walked out of there, I said, by God, that'll never happen to me again. I'm going to cure that stupidity. So I went to work on cross-examination. Now, you know, I'm not an F. Lee Bailey, who's reported, by the way, as being the nation's number one cross-examiner. I don't claim to be an F. Lee Bailey, but I'm okay. I'm satisfactory. I can get the information I need out of a witness when I get him on the stand. And if I can catch him lying, I'll eat his lunch. And I can teach you how to do the same thing. Now, while DNA fingerprinting is based on well-tested genetic assumptions, traditional methods generally rest on the assumption of discernible uniqueness. This is a common supposition that two apparently identical-looking marks were produced by the same object. The problem with this assumption is that there's no way to verify it. That's not science, boys and girls. That's flipping a coin. There's no way to verify it. If forensic scientists find no unexplained differences between two marks, they infer that the marks were made by the same person or object, he said. But how do we know this to be so? Now, there are a number of DNA exonerations. Forensic errors are common. I'm going to underline that. Forensic errors are common. Forensic errors are as common as pig tracks in a barnyard, kids. Now, that doesn't mean that we should never rely upon forensics. We should test the forensics three times. At least three times. When the government, the state's crime lab, comes out and says, this bullet was fired from this gun. Okay, that's one. Now, let's take the same gun, and let's take the same bullet, and let's get a court order. Let's file a motion, let's get a show cause hearing, let's bring in the subject matter before the court's attention, or to the court's attention, and let's take it to a second laboratory and see if they concur. And if they concur, that's two. Then let's take it to a third one and say, what do you say? And if the third one concurs, then we could be pretty well certain that if three crime labs, if three laboratories fire a bullet out of this gun, and all three of them say, that bullet that we fired out of this gun matches the bullet that you gave us as a sample, we could be pretty sure that that's true. But boys and girls, when you get one or two that disagree, then right away that tells you, hey, wait a minute, this isn't science now. Science is something that we can reproduce and we can duplicate time after time after time after time. And it's never varying. It's always the same. Now, that's truth. That's fact. That's real. Now, what we see on CSI would lead us to believe that this science is absolute, but these forensic errors are common, despite industry claims to the contrary, according to the study. Now, we do have some studies over here that show that there are errors over here now. We've got documentation. How many errors are there? How common is this? I don't know. The people that are running the show, they're not admitting to it. The FBI says, we're not going to let anybody second guess our results. We're not going to let anybody come in here and test us to see whether or not we're accurate. Why not? FBI? Hey, FBI, how come? I mean, if you're as accurate as you claim to be, then if you're tested by any other laboratory anywhere, they are going to corroborate your thesis that you are perfect and that you don't make any mistakes. They're going to corroborate you. And the reason that you don't want anybody else testing your results is because you know that your results are flawed and skewered from time to time, and that you're going to be uncovered, and that the lie is going to be made manifest. That's why you don't want to be checked. As the old saying goes, if you don't have anything to hide, then why don't you bring it out into the open? Voice identification error rates are as high as 63%, depending on the type of voice sample tested. Handwriting error rates averaged around 40%. False positive error rates for bite marks run as high as 64%. Fingerprint examiners may fare a little better. But data from one forensic testing program showed that since 1995, one-fourth of the examiners have failed to correctly identify all of the latent prints in the test. Let me run that one by you again. 1/4 of the examiners. When we're not talking about the science of fingerprints, we're talking about the quality of the examiners who are interpreting the latent prints in the test. And 1/4 of the fingerprint experts now, that's 1 out of 4, falsely identifies the latent prints. Now, come on, defense attorneys. When somebody comes in here and says, well, I'm from the crime lab, and I'm an expert, and maybe I'm from the FBI, and these are the prints, and that's the guy's prints right over there, 25% of the time it's false. Now, the science or the technique of the fingerprints is fine, but we don't have a science in fingerprints, and we don't have standards for these fingerprint experts to follow. And so we have this human error. That's what the problem is. In one test, 20% of the examiners mistook one person's prints for those of his twin. Now, twins are going to have very similar prints. During the past decade, scores of people who were convicted of serious crimes have been exonerated by DNA analysis of crime scene evidence that had not been tested at the time of their trials. Well, if it hadn't been tested, why not? Where was the defense attorney over here? Drawing on data from 86 such cases, Kohler and his colleagues, Michael Sachs, a law professor at Arizona State University in Tempe, found that forensic science testing errors played a part in 63% of the wrongful convictions. The science was bad, or the technician was wrong. The study also found that forensic scientists are the witnesses most likely to present misleading or fraudulent testimony. In 27% of cases reviewed, expert witnesses were found to have given false testimony. That'll give you a little hope, boys and girls. If you're locked up in jail, or if you've got somebody that's locked up in jail, you know, there's ways, you know. There's a system, there's a methodology for getting that case reviewed and then proving your innocence. Not easy, but it's not impossible. It's not easy, but it's not impossible. And the guy that needs to take the lead is the guy who's locked up in jail. The guy that's actually locked up. That's the guy that needs to take the lead. You need to train that guy. And we have a training program here at the law school for training lay people. Not lawyer. Not scientists or others. Just lay people like yourself. Truck drivers and carpenters and plumbers and electricians and businessmen and so on. In how to do this. Now that we've identified what the problem is, now let's train ourselves and let's become competent. And then let's correct it. How's that for a plan? All right, I'm about out of time again, so let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. See you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.